From South Dakota to Louisiana, Texas to Michigan, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the United Auto Workers have begun a strike against three domestic car companies. What are the issues and what impact will that have on the overall economy? Sean Higgins from the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here to explain. There was much budget-related drama under the Capitol Dome this week as a potential partial government shutdown looms. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Public sector labor contracts are often negotiated behind closed doors with few, if any, details available to taxpayers. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine discusses the issue with Kevin Kane from the Commonwealth Foundation. And on his American Radio Journal commentary, Dr. Paul Kangor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College talks about the impact of the Abraham Accords on Mideast peace. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The United Auto Workers strike presents both an economic and political problem for the Biden administration, and down the road will impact the American consumer. Here to sort through the details of the strike is Sean Higgins. He is a research fellow with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Sean, before we get into the impact and the repercussions of the strike that's taking place here with the United Auto Workers, what are the issues at play here that created a situation, a climate where they felt the strike was necessary?
A couple of things. I mean, obviously, just simply the contract is up, and that's the obvious time to renegotiate it. But there's also the transition to electric vehicles, which is a major concern of the United Auto Workers Union. And there's also the issue that they have a new leader now, and this is his first sort of time up at bat, and he has to sort of make a strong impression, and this is going to sort of reverberate for a long time as to how people both in and outside the union view this guy. So he's trying to look tough and lead a charge and establish his reputation that way.
So far, the strike has only affected, one plant in each of the three automakers?
And that's correct, yes.
Are we expecting that this is going to grow and spread to more plants as this process goes along?
The supposed plan is to sort of randomly strike at different plants in the theory that this is going to create more disruption for the industry. And the leader of the UAW, Sean Fain, has threatened to expand the number of plants that they strike at. I should note, however, that this is a very unusual strategy. Historically, strikes have been all or nothing things. UAW has about 150,000 members or so, and currently only a few thousand of them are actually on strike. And that's very different from the way strikes usually were done. They were done, nobody works, it's a complete stoppage, and you just try and bring management to heel that way. And the fact they're trying it this way is quite a break from tradition.
Obviously, pay is a big issue here. And if you look at the fact, Sean, that over the last couple of years, we've had, a cumulative 18% or so inflation, are their wage demands really that far out of line when you look at the erosion of buying power that they and everybody else, for that matter, have experienced?
I don't think that they're that out of line in terms of, the decline in the basic buying power and other problems caused by inflation. Inflation is one of the very sort of insidious problems. We've been very lucky. We had several decades where we had basically no inflation, or at least marginal inflation. It's only recently come back in a strong way, and that's been a shock to a lot of people. That said, the industry is not in a very strong position. I mean, the UAW only represents about 40% of domestic manufacturers. They have serious competition with other companies that, there's a lot of foreign brands that are built in the U.S., and they're also, again, trying to make this transition to electronic vehicles, which require less labor than the traditional gas-powered vehicles. So they're arguing for more money at a time when the industry, frankly, they claim they can't afford it. And while companies always claim poverty, the fact is there is a serious economic transition happening right now where the labor just isn't as valuable as it used to be.
This may be more of a political than an economic question, but does this not put a lot of pressure on, say, the Biden administration, which has come under heavy criticism, even from the union, for its involvement or lack thereof in this strike? But the Biden administration is pushing very hard for conversion to EVs. So does this not sort of put them at odds with the goals of the union membership, which is also part of the president's political base.
It does put them at odds with the sort of long-term survival of the union, because they're pushing them towards a position where there's simply be less, there will be less jobs in the industry, and that's going to hurt them in the long run. The union, Fain and others seem to be taking the position that this transition is inevitable. We've just got to go along with it. You know, we can't simply expect the gas-powered vehicles to continue to be the future, so we're going to have to accept it in part. But it's a difficult situation for the administration for that reason. The other problem is, I mean, they intervened rather dramatically in the UPS strike recently. That was because the Teamsters threatened to strike, and they threatened to disrupt the supply chain, and that would have had a much more immediate impact on the economy. The problem with an automobile manufacturer strike is, to the extent that the repercussions are going to reverberate into the broader public, that's going to be a much longer period of time before that happens. I mean, we can go without buying new cars for a while. In fact, dealerships might even appreciate a break because it means they can sell off the surplus they have on their lots. Most dealers actually make most of their money from servicing cars, not selling them. The problem is there isn't a sort of immediate crisis that a strike causes that was the case with the Teamsters and the UPS strike.
This will also have a supply chain ripple effect, though, won't it? Because, Sean, I'm sure there are a lot of suppliers who provide the parts, et cetera, to make these vehicles. We're going to see somewhat of a ripple through the economy?
We'll see somewhat of a ripple of the economy for that reason, yeah. But I was just saying, comparatively speaking to the UPS strike, it's not as strong. That's the reason why the administration actually stepped in and, in that case, forced a contract on both sides. In this case, they are sure keeping their hand, trying to keep out of it to the extent that they can and hoping it's basically resolved quickly so they don't have to do anything.
Down the road, obviously, if they're giving auto workers higher pay, maybe a shorter work week, better benefits, whatever, what do you see as the downstream effect to consumers, especially when it comes to the cost of buying a new automobile?
It's possibly dangerous for these companies. I mean, there are serious competition from other automakers in terms of buying these electric vehicles, and if the labor costs at Ford, GM, and Stellantis remain higher, they're going to have a harder time doing it profitably, and those companies will find themselves in a bad position as a consequence of that. The bottom line remains that only 40% of the domestic U.S. auto manufacturing is currently organized, and that 60% doesn't have these union issues, and they're gaining and have gained on the Detroit 3, basically, as a consequence of that. And until and unless either the unions figure out a way to organize the other companies, this relative disadvantage is going to continue for those Detroit manufacturers.
What has been the trend with labor unionization in auto building plants? Have we seen new plants being built largely in non-union right-to-work type states?
Yeah. I mean, most of the new production is in the South and states that have right-to-work laws and states that aren't organized. The unions have made periodic bids and efforts to organize them in places like Tennessee and Chattanooga, but they just haven't had a whole lot of success doing it. There just isn't. In the South, Southerners just tend to have a sort of much more stubbornly iconoclastic view of this type of thing, and they don't much appreciate people coming in from outside telling them how to do things, which is the case when organizers show up. And they haven't figured out how to way to sort of get a genuine grassroots effort going. And part of the problem the union has is that they went through so many decades with auto manufacturing being centered to Detroit and being pretty much completely covered by the UAW that they sort of fell out of the habit or tradition of organizing new plants because they just didn't need to. And then suddenly when the foreign manufacturers came into the U.S. and started locating in places like South Carolina and Tennessee, they were caught flat-footed, and they don't really have a presence there, and they don't really know how to reach those people. And you know, they're going to have to try and figure out some way to do that if they're going to survive in the long run.
We have been talking about the United Auto Workers strike. We've been doing that with Sean Higgins, who is a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, tell us a bit about CEI, and also give us a website, because you write a lot on these various issues.
We're a free market nonprofit think tank located in Washington, D.C., and you can find us at CEI.org.
Sean Higgins from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, thank you for being back with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Well, it's been quite a week in Washington, D.C., and the budget deadline is approaching. Much drama. We're going to talk about it with Scott. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Thank you for doing the show this week from an airport as you dash from place to place. So we'll tell our listeners, if you hear a little bit of chatter in the background, well, airport interviews can be that way. But you have been keeping an eye on Capitol Hill, the budget deadline approaching in just a few days. Where do things stand?
This week in Washington, we had a lot of that D.C. drama all over what's known as a CR. CR stands for Continuing Resolution, and it's basically a stopgap funding measure that would continue federal appropriations at current levels. Now, I think the status quo is unacceptable, and so do most of the House conservatives. So they're trying to engage in this big negotiation among a wide array of ideological factions within the House, from the hard right all the way over to the moderates that are in the so-called Tuesday group. And they've had a really hard time establishing what the top line levels of federal funding is going to be for appropriations. If you're just doing a CR at current levels, it's basically rubber stamping the current omnibus that we're operating under for the next few days, which was passed late last year underneath President Biden and his administration, working with Congress to really do a bill that didn't have any Republican input. And with this House Republican majority, we have real power. And it's time for the House conservatives to work across the conference to flex that power and try to get a product that reflects fiscal sanity and economic growth and really holds the Biden administration accountable. The problem is that too many people fear the messaging battle. They fear taking that tough vote. And so we haven't been able to get to an agreement yet. There hasn't been a bill signed into law. You've got the United States Senate that's considering sending over their own CR to the House and jamming the House. But all that plays into the political drama surrounding Speaker Kevin McCarthy as well. So I think this is an instance where House conservatives do have leverage. I think they've proven that with taking down the Defense Appropriations Bill procedural vote on what's known as the rule. Now, that's not a vote against our Department of Defense or our men and women wearing uniform or not a vote against military readiness. It is basically a vote that they've taken down because they're trying to establish how much money are we going to spend, not just on defense, but across the board in all these areas of the federal government. Because if we just proceed with the status quo, they believe conservatives will get rolled at the end of the year with an omnibus appropriations. And I think that they're right, because all you got to do is look at the last 20 years, and that's what happens year after year after year. But there's patriots out there like Eli Crane and Dan Bishop and Matt Rosendale and Andy Biggs and many, many others that are fighting on this. You also have a big personality brouhaha that's been front and center between Matt Gaetz and Speaker McCarthy. I think that there's a lot of trust lost right now that needs to be reestablished. And hopefully next week we get to a resolution. But there's this shutdown drama in Washington, and you and I have read the chapter of that book before. It usually isn't as overblown as people make it out to be in the moment, but it is still a concern, I think, for a lot of federal contractors and some federal workers.
Well, and that's always the pressure that's put on conservatives is, well, we'll have a government shutdown. And of course, when there's a government shutdown, they always shut down the most sensitive pressure points first in order to advance their cause. But is there actually a path forward here or a way out of this dilemma, Scott?
Well, I think the path forward is adding conservative things to the framework that existed between the moderates and the conservatives that was launched earlier this week. Chip Roy, Byron Donalds, and Scott Perry represented the Freedom Caucus, and they worked with three of the moderates, and they basically came together with a framework, but that framework fell way short. And so I think that it's a starting point, but you need to add conservative provisions to start to peel off votes. It is a vote-counting exercise, and we know that the majority in the House is incredibly slim. So it'll be something that you and I are going to be watching. I think the American people are very interested in watching it as well. But we shouldn't just cave to our principles to accommodate the uniparty and the establishment that are continuing to bankrupt America. Our national debt is over $33 trillion. And the proposal that was before Congress at the beginning of this week only cut spending by $3.7 billion. So it's not like they're solving our debt crisis today, but I think that we need to have transformational reforms that do put us on a trajectory to a better America for all communities and all people.
Let's switch now to political developments. We do like to keep tabs on major political developments in key races for both House and Senate around the country. Just a couple of days ago, major development in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Republicans got their candidate. Who is he?
Well, this is a race where Senator Casey is up for re-election, and Republicans at the National Republican Senatorial Committee and throughout America have been really pushing Dave McCormick to give it another shot. Mr. McCormick took second place last year in the United States Senate race to Dr. Oz. Dr. Oz obviously lost a very, very close race to John Fetterperson, better known as John Fetterman or John Fetter something. John Fetter wears a sweater. But anyways, McCormick's in the race. He's going to be a top-tier candidate that gives Pennsylvania the opportunity to flip that state red.
Well, and we understand that Dave McCormick is not prone to wearing gym shorts on the floor of the U.S. Senate. That was another big kerfuffle this week, wasn't it?
Yeah, the Senate changed their dress code to accommodate some of the situations with members, including Senator Fetterman. And I think that, you know, obviously the institution has required a dress code where men are supposed to be wearing business attire on the floor. I think it's a situation that sort of deteriorates the institution of the United States Senate. And if you can't dress up for work, then maybe that's not a job you're cut out to have.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. Everybody can check us out at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, thank you for being here.
Okay, thank you.
In most states, public sector labor negotiations lack transparency, with few, if any, details made available to either union members or to taxpayers. To learn more, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Kevin Kane of the Commonwealth Foundation.
We've got a number of strikes that have been in the news recently. You've got the writer's strike out in Hollywood. You've got auto workers now striking across the Midwest. And so I thought this was a good opportunity, a good chance to talk about maybe not those private sector strikes, but the way union contracts are negotiated, and in particular, the way public sector union contracts are negotiated. It's maybe a bit of a dry topic, but an important one, one that you probably haven't thought about a lot. And one of the key details in the way this works is the complete lack of transparency in these negotiations. And that is what we're going to take a close look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Kevin Kane. He's the Director of Legislative Strategy at the Commonwealth Foundation in Pennsylvania. We welcome him to the show. Kevin, thanks for taking some time with us.
Eric, thank you so much. Happy to be here.
We're going to get into a specific proposal in Pennsylvania in just a minute. But Kevin, let's start this kind of big picture. These public sector union contracts, every state, every city negotiates these with their public workers. But all those negotiations happen behind closed doors. Taxpayers don't get to know really any of those dirty details.
Right, Eric. And while it may be a dry topic, it's something that every taxpayer and public sector worker should be interested in. Because not only does this affect the people who are working in these union jobs, but anybody who pays taxes is fitting the bill for a lot of what's happening behind closed doors in these contracts.
And one of the things that's always struck me, Kevin, about the way this works is that it's in a private sector union, you've got the management on one side, and you've got labor on the other side, and they're negotiating against each other. In public sector union negotiations, it's like the politicians and the unions are negotiating over how much the taxpayers will have to pay, and the taxpayers don't get to know.
Right. Well, and it's especially problematic, too, because a lot of our research shows that most public sector unions are some of the key campaign donors to a lot of the politicians in charge, running the show.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got, you know, they're funding the politicians who are then negotiating the contracts. It leaves the taxpayers out of the loop. Let's talk about, this is a Senate Bill 399 in the Pennsylvania Senate that's been proposed. And this is a part of an effort actually in a number of states, but this one in particular is looking at, kind of pulling that curtain back a little bit. Tell us a bit about what the bill does.
Senator Pat Stefano has done a great job raising this issue, and we're pleased to see the Senate move it forward. But it's pretty straightforward. This bill is about accountability, transparency, and good government. Senate Bill 399 simply requires public notice of a collective bargaining agreement prior to its approval. So all we're asking is, can you post the collective bargaining agreement that's been proposed? And then just give us a cost estimate. So we'll not only let the workers see, hey, what's in the contract that will impact things like your salary and benefits, but let the taxpayers see, hey, this is what it's going to cost to get this thing done. And it's important for taxpayers especially because a lot of times, these contracts drive local and state taxes.
Yeah, and I think this is, again, one of those things that it sounds just basic common sense to me, but it's something that, and I think it's probably the way most people assume this process plays out, right? That, like, you would get to see it. Any piece of legislation, any major thing that's done by a government is always going to be, you know, you're going to see it ahead of time. You see a bill that's written, you know, before it gets passed, at least maybe only a few hours before it gets passed, but you see it. And that's just, again, it's just not at all the way this contract works. What would be the time periods here? How much more transparency do you get? How much time do taxpayers get to know, get to see this stuff before it would become, before it would be agreed to?
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, it's common sense and pretty reasonable. Unfortunately, those things don't always happen in Harrisburg. But Senate Bill 399 proposes that the agreement and cost estimate must remain on the public employer's website 30 days after signing. If they don't have a website, there are requirements that they must print and post a copy of the proposed agreement and some of the cost estimates in their main office for the same duration. But the key piece of this legislation that I think where there's some real teeth and it would actually benefit, again, workers and taxpayers, is that any bargaining agreement that continues to operate behind closed doors in darkness and they fail to provide the required public notice is null and void.
Yeah, so you take it out of the shadows, you take it out of those back rooms where you've got the politicians on one hand and the public sector unions on the other, making these deals without anybody seeing what's going on. We're talking with Kevin Kane, he's the Director of Legislative Strategy at the Commonwealth Foundation. Talking about a proposal in Pennsylvania to increase some transparency in these public sector union negotiations. But Kevin, this is something that other states are working on too. It's something that I think there's like 15 states that have some degree of transparency on the way this collective bargaining process plays out. We'd only have not a lot of time left here, final minute or so. Can you give me an example of like a state where this works particularly well, where we've maybe seen some benefits from this kind of transparency?
Well, you hit it on the head, and I look at places like Texas and Louisiana. Those are two states that require public posting of proposed collective bargaining agreements before the agreements are approved. So giving workers and taxpayers a heads up before these negotiations occur. Neighboring Ohio is another good example. But you know what, Eric? This hits pretty close to home here in Pennsylvania. We've seen recently Governor Shapiro negotiated AFSCME's contract that over the span of its lifetime is estimated to cost $3.2 billion. And nobody got a chance to take a look at that ahead of time. And AFSCME was one of the governor's top campaign contributors. We've seen in Pennsylvania, too, the harm this has on workers. Up in Erie, there was a group, again, AFSCME's involved, you got some of the players here, but up in Erie, we had workers who were not given an option and were kind of just told by their union, hey, this is the contract we're going with. And later it came out, the workers actually preferred one of the other options. They didn't have a chance to make their voice heard. So again, this is about accountability, transparency, good government, and just giving people a fair shake and a heads up of what the people who are making key decisions that impact their lives, it's letting them have a say.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. And, you know, from my perspective here, I think it's also transparency for the media. It gives us something to dig into when these contracts get negotiated, which is important as well for the way democracy is supposed to function. That's unfortunately all the time we have for today. Kevin, thanks for taking some time with us.
Thank you for having me, Eric.
And again, that's Kevin Kane. He's the Director of Legislative Strategy at the Commonwealth Foundation. Check out his work and Commonwealth Foundation's excellent work on a wide variety of topics at commonwealthfoundation.org. They are the free market think tank in Pennsylvania. Check them out there. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out our coverage online at reason.com and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The Abraham Accords were a major step toward ending hostilities between Israel and Arab nations. The agreement is worth remembering, says Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College on this American Radio Journal commentary.
This September, Americans once again remembered September 11, 2001. Of course, every September 11th has become a somber day to memorialize the nearly 3,000 victims that were destroyed that day in 2001 by the homicidal bombers of Osama bin Laden. But for this September 2023, I think we should consider the anniversary of something else in the Middle East, something that was much more constructive and, frankly, continues to produce fruit. I'm thinking of the Abraham Accords that were negotiated in September 2020. The Accords were appropriately named for the great Jewish patriarch Abraham, who's the common forefather of Jews, Christians, and Arabs. The Abraham Accords was a series of agreements to normalize relations between the nation of Israel and several major Arab nations that theretofore had never before recognized Israel's right to exist. Think about that. fact, quite the contrary, some had gone to war with Israel. The countries were the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan. The accords were mediated by the United States, and specifically the Trump administration, with President Trump's senior advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, playing the primary role as the chief negotiator. The first nation to join Israel in the accords was the United Arab Emirates, with Bahrain following next in a historic announcement on September 11, 2020. Morocco and Sudan soon followed. As I give this commentary, a bunch of additional Arab nations may be signing on to the accords. Discussions have taken place with Oman, Indonesia, Somalia, and more. In fact, amazingly, even Saudi Arabia, the home of Mecca. These two are thoroughly Muslim nations that once did not have friendly relations with Israel. For a sense of how extraordinary this achievement has been, prior to the Abraham Accords, the only Arab nations that had recognized Israel's right to exist were Egypt via the Camp David Accords of the late 1970s, that was negotiated by President Jimmy Carter, and Jordan via a superbly crafted peace agreement signed with Israel in 1994, and that one was mediated by the Clinton administration. Prior to September 2020, the only Arab nations thus that had broken ranks from the United Hostile Front of Arabs had been Egypt and Jordan. And yet, in a matter of mere weeks in September 2020, the Trump administration doubled that number. Among those four countries of the Abraham Accords, Sudan was especially striking. Sudan had once been home of the Arab League's infamous Three Noes of Khartoum in 1967. That said, quote, no recognition of Israel, no negotiations with Israel, and no peace with Israel. In fact, Sudan in 2020 officially signed the Abraham Accords declaration in the city of Khartoum. That's a dramatic change and symbolism that's quite remarkable. Overall, this is wonderful recent history. So why isn't it celebrated or commemorated as it should be? I think the answer is clearly political. The Abraham Accords was signed by the various Arab country representatives and Israeli Prime Minister Ben Netanyahu with President Donald Trump as witness. As noted, they were negotiated by Trump's son-in-law. This was, in short, a Trump triumph. Moreover, the Accords were first announced in September 2020, just weeks before the November 2020 presidential election. Partisan liberal journalists and news outlets were not about to hail the Abraham Accords as a great Trump accomplishment on the eve of the presidential election. Had this been a grand diplomatic victory by a Democratic president, the news would have dominated the headlines into the election. They would have been polishing up the Nobel Peace Prize. And for the record, I say that as someone who's not a fan of Donald Trump. But I do think there's no disputing that he didn't receive due recognition for the Accords for political reasons. Nonetheless, the Abraham Accords may well be the number one achievement for peace and stability in the post-9/11 Middle East. They're especially positive when measured against the disastrous Biden withdrawal from Afghanistan that brought back the return of the Taliban on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. Best of all, what the Trump administration bequeathed continues to bear fruit. As the children of Abraham move forward, hopefully with more covenants of peace still to come. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengore. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WWOS-FM in Orangeburg, South Carolina, WJAS-AM in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, along with WFYL-AM in Jeffersonville, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.